Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone if you'd like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I'd like to turn the meeting over to Denise Merle, Connecticut Secretary of State. You may begin.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. Well, here we are, 2 weeks out, not even, and I want to thank you for tuning into this call. We have a number of very important issues to bring up with you today. But first of all, I want to thank you for all the work I know this is out there. I don't know if you have heard, but I have been constantly in the press talking about our election administration, how it works, and how much work all our election administrators and poll workers and literally hundreds and thousands of people involved in elections work to get ready for this great event. That being said, it's an exciting time, and I hope we are all ready to go. And today we're going to talk about a number of issues that have either come up during the campaigns or that we think you need to be thinking about that just are sort of last-minute reminders of various things. I just want to say one word about cybersecurity. You know, this has been an election where administration of elections has been in the news, on the front page across the country. And I would like to update you on our preparations in case there is some sort of attack on, I guess, what would have to be our voter registration system. I have pointed out numerous times, really nationally, that there are election tabulators, which are the ones that tabulate the results, as you know, are not connected to the internet. And I haven't been able to say it often enough because there's still a sense out there that there will be some sort of attack on our election results. And as we all know, that would be extremely difficult and highly improbable. However, there also has been discussion about attacks that have come on our CVR systems across the country. And there was a widely reported story about a cyber attack in June or July, I believe, where a number of states, probably almost all states, reported having what we call pings, I guess, against from IP addresses from outside the country. I just want to let you know the exact status of that in Connecticut is, yes, we also were pinged, which is a version of, I guess, an attack. However, it was unsuccessful. And that's very important to realize because it just means that our security systems are working. Apparently, there are these pings all the time against all kinds of government and private sector systems. It's just when they breach the security walls that it becomes a problem. So there were two states where I guess they did breach those security walls, Arizona and Illinois, and even in those cases, there was no evidence of tampering with the actual data for any particular reason. So we don't know what that was all about. Nonetheless, there have been extensive preparations, both here and across the country, in conjunction with the Department of Homeland Security. I am on a committee, a very small committee, that's talking about how we will communicate on Election Day should there be any kind of attack like this that would impact us. But we have backup systems within backup systems. DHS has offered another system which we have availed ourselves of, but our servers are maintained by DOIT, not by our office, so we will be in constant contact with them on Election Day, and there will be a discussion nationally about a communication system between us and the national DHS, which also would be quickly, we would be quickly informed if there was any kind of attack like that on any part of our election administration system. So just to assure you, there is plenty going on, and I think I would put that kind of on the bottom of the list of the things I'm concerned about on Election Day. But just so you know, again, in many instances, the real key to all of this is communication, and that is something we're going to talk to you about today because, you know, with this very decentralized election system, 169 towns, each of you administering the election in that town, it's key that if there's any problem, and, you know, we've had them, mostly storms in the past. But, you know, whatever it is, we need to be able to communicate directly with you quickly. So that's some of what we're going to talk about today. That's all from me. I think I'll now turn it over to Peggy Reeves. I think you all know Peggy, election director. So thank you, Peggy. Take it away.
Thank you, Secretary Merrill. So I wanted to welcome everyone here this morning, and I want to thank you, because I was thinking the other day, we were talking about this. You had three challenges this year. We had a new accessible voting machine you all had to be trained on, and I know you all attended that training. We have a new election management system that you'll all be using on election night. Remember that the fax to email machines will be shut off, turned off. They will not be available, so you all have to enter your results in the election management system, and we will be here to help you, by the way. We'll have people working on a help desk, people from PCC and our office will be here to help you do that. And your third challenge is Election Day registration in a presidential year. And we are all concerned about that, but I know that you have all worked extra hard to make sure that you have the staff available. We've given you guidelines in terms of how many people you should be using to staff those EDR sites. And we also have been discouraging people from waiting until the last minute, and I know that you have too. We still have less than a week to go. On November 1st will be your deadline for voter registration, and we do hope that people will use that to register to vote and not wait until November 8th. But for those who do get up on the morning of November 8th and say, you know, after all, I think I do want to vote, and I'm not registered, and so they may show up, and I know you will be prepared for them. So, again, I thank you for all the hard work and dedication you've done to make sure those three new programs that we've introduced this year are a success on November 8th. Now, another thing, let me just tell you on the outset that Ted and I will be playing a little tag team today and talking about subjects that we think are important and that you should be aware of. One of the things I wanted to mention, and I do want to say that we will give you more details later in an email, is that the issue that we reported recently about the problem with perhaps some colored ballots using the new accessible machines for the EDR site. We wanted to let you know that, in fact, it's a little more complicated than that. In many respects, it's actually going to be a little bit easier, and we will explain this in an email. But the problem seems to be not colored versus white per se. The problem is whether the printer used offset printing or digital printing. And so if the printer used offset printing, all of the ballots will be fine, including the colored ballots. So many of you who contacted me or Ted and said, we use the colored and they're fine. In fact, you can continue to use them for your accessible printing. The digital printing may have been used by a printer and for colored ballots only. But even in that particular case, what we would ask you to do is to run some samples. And if you do not see that what they call the ghosting effect, where something seems to be smearing from the type or the print, then you could be fine. And in fact, Jung has told us that probably 99% of you will not have an issue, but what we might request is that on the day of the election, you run a ballot just to make sure it's all right. It could be just an issue of the printer being overheated. So when you did your test X, the printer was overheated, and that was why some of you reported that smearing or the ghosting effect. And think about it, on election day, it will not have that constant use. There'll be plenty of time for that laser printer to cool down, and so you may not have the problem at all. And so we'll explain this more in an email, but I wanted to reassure you that it's not going to be so widespread as we thought, and you may be fine with using what you have already ordered for your EDR sites. Now, I wanted to talk, the next issue I wanted to talk about in a little bit of detail is we know what's happening in the country. There have been widespread news reports regarding observers or people who may go to your polls to see, to make sure that you're conducting everything correctly and according to law. Remember that we do not have an observer law in Connecticut. No one has the right to walk into your polling place and say that they're there to observe, to make sure that you, the election official, are conducting your responsibilities according to law. What we have instead, and let me mention the type of people who may be there. As you know, any voter is allowed to enter the polling place. Members of the media are also entitled to enter the polling place and to, in fact, take video if they wish. But if they become disruptive in any way, your moderator can ask them to leave. Obviously, children can come in, and any number of children can come in with their parents for the voting. You may have unofficial checkers and runners who, the runners may come in and out. Your unofficial checkers would be hired by you, the registrars of voters, and they're usually there for a set period of time during the day. But what would not be allowed to be in there is anyone, again, who walks in. And let me also indicate that there will be the political parties and the advocates may be putting together what they call voter protection advocates or volunteer attorneys. And those people may be standing outside your polling place checking for voter suppression or voter intimidation. Even if they call themselves volunteer attorneys, they are not the attorneys that we have the collaboration with the Connecticut Bar Association. Those attorneys who come on our behalf have to present a letter of designation signed by the Secretary of the State. They are not there to come in and just do a general observation. They are there because we have sent them there for a specific problem. They are there to be our eyes and ears on the ground, to take some information, and then to leave. So if you have any concerns or questions about that, please contact us on the day of the election, because, again, those people where they are there because they were sent there by us. And if anyone comes in and says he has a special badge and somehow he's a volunteer attorney for a particular candidate and you have to let him in the polling place, that is not the case. So please be sure that you talk to your moderators to make sure that they're in firm control of their polling place on Election Day, because it is especially important this year. One other group I wanted to talk about are your regional election monitors. We currently have 8 regional election monitors throughout the state, and they could be entering your polling place, but again, they will have a letter of designation from the Secretary of State, and they are there to help you. They are there to assist in any way if you need something on Election Day. But again, they would have that letter of designation, and you should probably actually have already met the particular regional election monitor for your district. If you have not, please let me know, and I will make sure that, in fact, they reach out to you, because I think it's important that you know who they are. All right, I'm going to actually turn it over to Ted to go down some of the issues and concerns he has on his list.
Thanks, Peggy, and thanks, Secretary Merrill. So what we're going to do is we're just going to run down a list of bulleted reminders that I have a bunch of topics. And for those of you that were at the Litchfield County meeting yesterday, many of these will be repeats, so apologize for that, but it was good seeing you guys yesterday. And also questions, I believe we'll be doing questions at the very end. So if you have any questions as we run down these lists, write them down and save them till the end. Okay. So the first is presidential ballots. We still do have presidential ballots in Connecticut, but they are drastically limited now with the onset of EDR. So back in 2003, when EDR was originally passed, in that same bill, presidential ballots were limited. So no longer do we have the ability of a resident of Connecticut who is simply not registered to vote and doesn't wish to be registered to vote to walk down to the town clerk's office, get a presidential ballot, and vote just for president. That is gone. Again, that's gone. The only presidential ballot that we have left is a presidential ballot for a former resident of Connecticut, meaning that I once lived in Connecticut. I moved to Texas, and because of my move, I missed the voter registration deadline in Texas. I can come back to Connecticut, and what I mean by that is you can even apply by mail. It can be done by mail for a presidential ballot back to the town where I once lived before I left. So we do have the former resident presidential ballot left. 2013, sorry for EDR. If I said 2003, I apologize. So we do have the former resident presidential ballot remaining, but we no longer have the current resident. So just keep that in mind. I only tell the registrars that simply because I am quite sure that you will at least get one person who tries to vote by presidential ballot with your clerk who is then unsatisfied with that result and comes down to complain to you as well. So let's just keep that in mind. So the second thing, a reminder, is voter registration deadline. So we had a recent change in the law, which was a great change, which is that now our voter registration deadline is the same for all of our voter registration mechanisms, meaning that the deadline for online voter registration, for mail-in voter registration, and for in-person voter registration is November 1st, 7 days prior to. Between November 2nd and November 7th, we still do have matured rights voters, meaning that anybody who has moved into your town, who has become a U.S. citizen, or who has become 18 in that period between November 2nd and November 7th can still register to vote with you in person during that period. Why I keep saying during that period is because invariably I will get a phone call, I guarantee it, during that period from somebody who says something like, I moved into town on October 1st, and I hear that I can register to vote between that period. Well, that's not the case. They have to move into your town within that period, become 18 within that period, or become a U.S. citizen within that period in order to register to vote within that period, meaning the 2nd through the 7th. But all is not lost, because remember that we have Election Day registration as well. But just keep in mind the matured rights section there. Okay, provisional ballots. Provisional ballots are in play this year. With Election Day registration, they are probably going to be limited in many instances, but they technically still are in play. So make sure that you have the necessary supplies at your polling place for provisional ballots. Provisional ballots can come into play in three different ways. One, if the voter is challenged. Two, if the voter was required to present some additional identification pursuant to the Help America Vote Act with their application for voter registration, and they don't. They're going to have a little asterisk next to their name on the list, and that means that they can no longer be an affidavit voter like us veteran voters on this line. They have to show some form of identification. And the third is that they storm into your polling place claiming that they're a registered voter. They have no idea why their name is not on the list, et cetera. That's technically another way that a provisional ballot would be triggered. Okay. So the provisional ballot, just as a reminder, is the overseas ballot, meaning it is just has the federal offices on it. So for this year, it would be President, U.S. Senate, and Rep in Congress. So I know that we had those printed up, and I know that they were sent, so send a few of those to the polling places along with the provisional ballot envelope, which I believe is the ED-250, and those are the supplies that are necessary. Okay. So Peggy already touched on observers, so I don't think we need to go there. The only thing that was asked of me, and now this is the third time it was asked of me, is weapons in the polling place or cell phones in the polling place. And we recently had the benefit of a visit from the FBI, who helped us clarify this a little bit in terms of weapons. So I'm not an expert in this. But apparently Connecticut's laws are such that obviously people can carry weapons, and it would be up to the local ordinance within the town. And so this is where we urge you to check with your local trooper, if you have a resident trooper, or your local police department, to find out where weapons can and cannot be carried within your municipality. Obviously, if your polling place is a town hall or a school, I'm a betting man that weapons are not allowed to be carried in those places. But if you have additional questions about that, rather than ask us, we're not experts, I would encourage you to ask the local police department about that. But cell phones, obviously cell phones are allowed in the polling place. And most recently, we were asked about the selfies in the polling place, wherein somebody would be taking a picture of their own ballot in the privacy booth. And Connecticut does not have a law that bars that. And with most recent court cases out there, the trend is that the courts are even saying that it is allowable. So as long as the individual is not being disruptive, standing in the middle of the polling place, dancing around or something like that, as long as they're doing it in the privacy of their privacy booth, they're not taking a picture of somebody else's ballot, not being disruptive, that would be allowable as well. Okay, Peggy touched on the attorney program as well. Another question has come up recently about the little ID posters that you have to post at the polling place next to the official checkers. We sent out a poster last year, I think it was, and we sent out two posters, one for a state election and one for a municipal election. You use the state election poster this year. We technically don't have in our statutes what's called a federal election. Any even-numbered year is technically a state election, so that's why the verbiage on the poster is like that. So be sure you're using the state election poster. And on that poster, there is a differentiation between the non-HAVA, or what I call the veteran voter, and the HAVA voter. And what is important to remember is, even with the HAVA voter, that only applies, and that should be getting less and less at this point, but that only applies to first-time mail-in voters. So if you have a first-time registrant that comes in person to your office, the additional HAVA ID doesn't even apply to that. It is only first-time mail-ins, and I think we do a good job on the poster of explaining that or making the differentiation. So take a look at that poster. And if you have any other questions, you can let us know.
Okay. So I'm sorry, I'm just going to jump in there. Remember, it's for first-time mail-in voters who lack information on their voter registration card. 90% of them will send you the information you need, but you'll get a certain number who either don't give you the last four digits of their social or their Connecticut driver's license number. And that's the only trigger, really, for the HAVA. So if you have a first-time mail-in who gave you everything that they needed, then they certainly are not the HAVA voter, and so those enhanced ID requirements do not apply.
Yeah, good. Thank you for that clarification. That's a very good point. Okay, and one of our last reminders before we get into a little more detail on a couple of topics is emergency plans. Now, you heard the Secretary and Peggy both talk about emergencies and things that we hope never happen, but please review your emergency plan. You know, a lot of times I will get a panic phone call from a registrar that says, well, the fire alarm is going off on the building, what do we do? And my response is, what does your emergency plan say to do? So please dust it off. Please review it with your moderators to make sure that you have your procedures in place for shortages of ballots, machine malfunctions, the building is not open on time, who do I call? All of those things should be part of your emergency plan. And just so you know, because I've been asked by a bunch of individuals, registrars and town clerks included, we do have backup plans ourselves here at the state level. We do have backup plans for a centralized voter registration system problem. Many of you helped us out on the recent tests of centralized voter reg, and many of you I know were experienced much better performance the second time. With your help, we were able to identify some things that we were able to make some changes, so we greatly appreciate that. But even with that done, even with that exercise done, we still have backup plans for that. Our state IT folks have a separate emergency server placed out of state that we can use. We have backup plans for centralized voter registration outage. We have a separate lookup tool not hosted on the state network, hosted at an alternative location that we're able to access as well. And also for election management, we will also be printing off hard copies of the head moderator's returns and have those available in case a problem happens with that. And we also even have alternative plans in case something happens at our office that we can literally relocate our entire office to a different building. So we have all of those things in place as well. So you should also be thinking about that at your local level and reviewing your emergency plan. Okay, so a couple of other detailed things that I want to go into. So Election Day registration, I'm sure that you have heard from us. You had heard what Peggy said. You know, this is the first time that we'll be using Election Day registration in a presidential year. So turnout is going to be the focus. And so please review your Election Day registration procedures and location to make sure that you have the capacity to handle an increase in turnout. An increase in turnout, by the way, obviously larger than even the latest gubernatorial election, probably 20 times as much. So if you haven't done that, please do that. A couple of reminders on Election Day registration. The online voter registration tool will be available to you for use at your Election Day registration location. So if you have plans to set up a laptop or a kiosk or a tablet, make sure that you have the flow in mind. Obviously, the idea with that is that somebody would have completed their application prior to getting to the Election Day registration desk, and so you would save yourself the data input, the henpecking that would need to be done if you had a hard copy card in front of you. But also, you know, keep in mind the little things like if you're using a laptop, if you're using a tablet, and something goes wrong with that, you need to have your local IT available to help you with any of those situations. So you know, keep those little things in mind for Election Day registration. Another thing that we are getting phone calls about is the 75-foot rule, I guess, for lack of a better word. 75-foot signs are posted outside, 75 feet from any outside entrance used as an entrance to the polling place. It's a radius, as somebody correctly pointed out at our meeting yesterday. It's not a box. It's, you know, it's a radius. But one thing that we do remind you of, and I'm sure that many of the towns that have encountered this have already figured that out, is that, you know, if 75 feet is in the middle of the street, you don't put the sign in the middle of the street. You know, put it, you know, beyond the street, onto the sidewalk or the curb or wherever it is, obviously, and clearly we don't have people, campaigners, standing in the middle of the street. Things of that nature. So, you know, use your common sense. The one thing that I would say is that if 75 feet is in the middle of the road, then obviously you would go beyond the road rather than go to 60 feet or something of that nature. So, electioneering. So inside 75 feet, there are certain things that can't be done, one of which is to wear political paraphernalia inside 75 feet. And we've gotten a lot of questions about this from individuals, and we're working on it. We promise that we are. It's just that the candidates this year have done an amazing job of not pigeonholing themselves into any one particular slogan or whatever. They're being very diverse. And so what we can tell you at this point is that true to what we have done for years and years and years is that anything that has a candidate's picture on it, the candidate's name, such as, you know, Hillary for president, Trump for president, that kind of thing, or a readily identifiable campaign slogan, such as the H with the arrow in it, or the Trump Pence, or something of that nature, those are, I think, are non-questionably not allowable. The same goes true that we've said for years and years, the red, white, and blue donkey, the red, white, and blue elephant, the donkey tie, those types of things. So those are all consistent advice. But what when we get to the slippery slope is that people, you know, ask, and I gave, I thought, was which was a good example yesterday as well, you know, what about an H that is not an H with an arrow, Ted? You know, I can come up with many. You know, I went to a college where my logo was an H. So, you know, if I walk in with my college T-shirt on that says Hobart College with the H and the different colors in it, I don't think clearly that, or a Harvard T-shirt or a wherever else is an H. I think that some of this has to be a case-by-case basis, and it's simply just very difficult for us to give you that fail-proof 100% answer. But we're still working on it, and to the extent that we have additional advice on that, we will give it to you. But I think our historical consistent advice at this point is at least still relevant. Okay, so IBS. I know that Peggy talked about some of the paper issues. The only thing that I wanted to say about the IBS system was that, of course, you should have gotten your thumb drive in the mail. I know that Tammy from IBS sent an email out that some people had questions about yesterday, which was that you could either download it by using your own USB drive, or you could wait for the one from IBS, and that's true. The one from IBS will have the programming on it. I know that many of you, even at the meeting yesterday, had said you had already successfully tested your equipment, and that is great. Remember that there needs to be an IBS package at the Election Day registration location, as well as at all of your polling places. And there was a couple of towns that have reported that when they, you know, tried to boot up the laptop or something, there was a problem. And I know IBS is right on the spot on that, making sure that there is replacement equipment available. So if you haven't already done that, please do that, testing your equipment so that we know if there is any outstanding issues with that. And finally, as Peggy already said again, election management system is in play for all towns. We will have a help desk available with not only our staff, but also individuals from that you've already met if you've gone to an IBS class, Brad and Linda, I believe. So they will be familiar voices to you. They are certainly the experts on that, so we will have them available as well. If you all have a pen, I will give you the direct dial phone number to that help desk. So I'll just pause a second, grab a pen. 860-509-6111. Again, 860-509-6111. And as I said, we do have even contingency plans for that, which is that we will have hard copy head moderators returns available. But the election management system is in play for all towns, which means that you should at this point have already, if you haven't done already, logged in, assigned your polling places to the election, set up your head moderators, made them active. Those are the bare bones that you need. Certainly give us a call if you are having problems with that. And then on election day, the data entry, I think we've been over it, but we do have a new way to data enter, which is we replace the lock and unlock with a red and green button, hopefully to make it easier. And I think the thing to remember is that if the button is red, that means somebody is working in that particular district. If the button is green, it means that you can enter that district. And when you submit those offices to the state, make sure everything is green. If there is still a district that's locked in red, it is not going to be successful. So those are just a few brief reminders. Certainly give us a call if you have any additional questions about that. So that is my laundry list. I'm gonna send it back over to Peggy, who I think has a little more information and reminders for you, and then we can indicate some questions at that point.
Thank you very much, Ted. I was thinking back over the years, the type of questions we get on Election Day, and they're often about voter ID issues, and that's because we'll get calls first from voters who say the lines are really long, and it seems like the checkers are taking a really long time to process the people, and it's because there still exists a little bit of confusion about voter ID. And so I just wanted to, again, remind all of you to make sure that your checkers understand that, of course, many will be presenting the driver's license, and that's great. It has a photo on it. It has an address on it. But according to our law, they don't have to show you that. So they can show you a credit card, and all it has on it is my signature. But under the law, remember, you can show, and this is for most voters, the veteran voters, you can show name and photo, name and signature, or name and address. So the problems will be that the line will fill up because the checker will say, I can't accept this credit card. And so then they have to go talk to the assistant registrar or to the moderator. And that's obviously what you want to avoid this year of all years. So make sure that they all understand that certainly the credit card works. If I have, for example, my badge from the Secretary of State's office, it has my photo on it, it has my name on it, it has nothing else. It doesn't have my address on it. But that's fine, and I can just show that because, remember, you're not proving residency. You've already proved that when you registered to vote. All you're proving on Election Day is that you are the voter on that checklist. And so this is me, and this is my photo, this is my signature, and so that should quickly go through the lines. And the other thing that I can show, and I know this sometimes people are confused about this, is that if I happen to have a Florida driver's license because I am a snowbird, this is my legal residence because I spend 6 months and one day in Connecticut, but I happen to, for whatever reason, have a driver's license in Florida, I can show that Florida driver's license because, again, it's just my name and photo, and the residence, the address on it is just irrelevant. So I wanted people to understand that so that they understand that that's the case. And Ted's going to talk about veterans.
So what I just wanted to clarify so that we don't get a bunch of questions on that is that Peggy is absolutely right, but again, what she was talking about were veteran voters. Veteran voters, okay?
Not HAVA voters.
Not HAVA voters. That is a different set of ID. It's laid out on your little ID poster, but what she was referring to were veteran voters. So, you know, please keep that segregated.
Okay, and one more thing, obviously, if lacking all of that, they can sign that affidavit, which you will all have either on the checkers table or you'll have it on your moderator's table. You'll have it somewhere where you can just quickly give that form to them to sign the affirmation that they are the person on the checklist and they sign under penalties of false statements. So I think I'm just telling you this because I think it'll keep your lines moving quickly if you, in fact, go over this with your checkers ahead of time. I'm sure you already have, but just in case so that they understand what our rules are because they're a little more complicated perhaps than some other states. And for good reason, I think that we try to make it easy for people to vote. Certainly once they're registered to vote. Okay, so I think that's all we were going to talk about for this morning. So we are now going to open it up to your questions, and we'd like to hear what you would like to ask any of us to help you get ready for the election.
Participants on the phone, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. Please make sure your line is unmuted and record your first and last name clearly with the prompt. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment for incoming questions. Our first question comes from Susan Day. Your line is now open.
I'm sorry, I hit the wrong button. I have no question. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Dorothy. Your line is open. Again, caller, your line is open. Please ask your question. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment for additional questions. We have a question from Vincent Caprio. Your line is open.
Hi. We've had a number of residents in this town who have come to us and said when they were children, their parents brought them into the voting booth to see how voting worked. So a number of people have said to me they have minors, say someone in eighth grade, they'd like to bring into the voting booth to show their child a civics lesson. I don't believe we're allowed to let minors into a voting booth. Isn't that correct?
Actually, no. That we still have a statute on the books that allows parents to bring in their children into the poll, into the voting booth. I believe it's a cutoff at 15.
15 and under.
15 and under. So it's 15 and under. Parents can still bring their children into the polls and into the voting booth to view the experience, the process.
Yeah, I'm just going to add to. I'm just going to add to that I think it's a terrific idea, actually. It is your first lesson in civics, and many, many people have told me they still remember when their parents brought them in. So as a former teacher, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we want to make sure that the kids aren't coloring in the, you know, on the ballot and making it be rejected by the machine and stuff. So there is a level of caution there, but certainly there's still a statute on the books to allow them to do it.
And the children also should not insert the ballot into the tabulator. That is, only the voter is allowed to insert that ballot in the tabulator.
Okay. Okay, so next question, please.
Our next question comes from Deborah. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Attorney Ted, this is Deborah from Milford. I'm sorry, we still have a question regarding that overseas ballot. When someone requests an overseas ballot, true or false, they have to have an address that is available in Milford. If that street, that house does not exist, how do we communicate that? I've sent emails to the voter and we still don't have an address in Milford. Am I missing something here? Do we not have to have a legitimate address in Milford on our street address before we can put them in the system in order for the city clerk to process an overseas ballot?
Right. So, well, a couple of things. First is that, yes, if we're talking about truly an overseas voter, and for those town clerks that are on the line, do we have town clerks or just registrars? Oh, so the town clerks know that that I use the word overseas very specifically because it's a very specific ballot. An overseas voter, by definition, is somebody who once lived in Connecticut and now moved overseas permanently. They are not a registered voter, and you would not put them in the centralized voter registration system. That individual would go directly to the town clerk, and the town clerk would issue a ballot as a former resident overseas voter, and that ballot only has federal offices on it. Now, to your question, yes, they have to have a former residence in your town where they lived prior to moving overseas. They have to be able to identify, especially in those towns, which might be divided or carved up by specific senatorial assembly or congressional districts. So that would be important. But I think communicating and helping the voter out, this voter might have moved overseas 20 years ago. It doesn't matter. There's no time frame for overseas voters. And you know, maybe where they lived, maybe that house has been torn down or something. So I would urge you to keep trying to identify with them. But, yeah, there needs to be an identifiable location, especially if your town is broken up into districts.
Okay, which leads me to the street address that she gave us is now public domain. If the house was probably taking if she was there. So do we put that, enter that address into our street list and accept it?
Well, again, when you say street list, I'm not sure what you're talking about. You're not talking about registering them, are you?
Yes.
Well, no, you wouldn't do that.
The person is planning to come back, but their house is no longer there.
So I'm not, what, which box did they check on the federal postcard?
Just a minute. They were uncertain of their return.
Okay, that's an overseas ballot.
They don't get registered.
Your town clerk should be very familiar with that one. I would communicate with your town clerk. I go over that ad nauseum with them. So, yes, those two boxes, they're never going to return or the return is uncertain. By definition, those are simply overseas ballots. They do not get registered. It's a federal office-only ballot. It's on a list by your town clerk, not held by you, and it's an absentee ballot.
Let him go.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it. We have one other question by Beth.
My question is on these monitors that you say, excuse me, can come into the polling place and that they would have a piece of paper signed by the Secretary of State. Can that piece of paper be identified in any other way, or can you supply us with a list of the names of these people? Because if a piece of paper can be copied and used, how do we know whether or not it's a legitimate document?
Well,
want me to do this?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Jamie.
Good morning. This is James Fallone, Deputy Secretary of the State. The document that is being issued is on the letterhead of the Secretary of the State. It's on her formal letterhead. It is sent by a PDF to the attorney in question. It is not sent by PDF to that attorney until we determine there's an issue that we'd like them to address. So we receive a call from a town. We determine that this requires more information in our office. We then contact the attorney to make sure they're available. We then send a PDF letter to them, which they then print out and bring to the office. So we don't even give it to them in advance. I just want to check with my colleagues here. Does the letter have their name on it, the particular attorney?
Yeah.
So it's so specific. It's not a blanket letter just for that. I mean, for everyone. It's just for that attorney, so their name is on it. We tend to not indicate ahead of time who's assigned and where they might be going, in order to ensure sort of the pre-election confidentiality of the program, so that it's as effective as possible.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. And just one other thing, we have not met our regional monitor. Peggy, thank you.
Which town are you from? I'm sorry.
Milford.
Oh, this is still Milford. Okay, all right. I am going to make a note. Oh, wait. Milford may not have one.
Okay.
So there is one council of government.
Yeah.
It's the Bridgeport metropolitan area.
Okay.
And so I bet Milford does not have one, and I'm sorry about that, but they refuse to actually proceed with the program.
Yeah.
We're in New Haven County, but that still is under the greater Bridgeport?
Oh, well, there is a New Haven. It's the South Central COG, so I'm going to actually check.
Okay.
And we're going to determine whether Milford is under the South Central COG of New Haven or under the Metro COG, and we'll let you know.
Thank you, speakers. Our next question is from Karen Cheney. Your line is open.
Hi, Ted. Can you tell me if we're going to get the list of write-ins? There's a difference of opinion in Middlesex County whether that write-in should be posted next to the checkers table or whether or not we can't release it.
Okay. So, yes, we're working on the list of write-ins as we speak. The deadline was Tuesday. We will be getting them out. I know that Heather is also going to be putting it directly into the election management system for you. In terms of posting the list, you, Karen, you are, well, I don't know if you said one way or another. I was going to say you're correct, but now I think about it, I'm not sure whether you said one way or another. But we write in the letter, the write-in letter, we say that you're not to post it. There is a statute that dictates exactly what must be posted in the polling place. And only those things. So you have it available with either your moderator or your assistant registrars. If somebody walks in and wants to view it, certainly you can provide it. But there is nothing that allows you to post it either on the wall or by your checkers table.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Bonnie Anderson. You may begin.
Thank you. Could you talk about the difference in identification for EDR as opposed to the polls?
Sure. So EDR is different in that EDR, you need to prove two things. You need to prove identity and residency all at the same time. I think Peggy summed it up beautifully when she was talking about her ID in that you have already proved residency through the voter registration process. So at the polls for a normal veteran voter, all you're doing is proving identity. When you use the Election Day registration procedure, because you're both registering and voting all in the one fell swoop, you need to do both at the same time. So what the statutes say is that you need to prove both residency and identity. So if you are providing something like a driver's license that does both, then that's fine. But if you provide something such as a Social Security card, because under 9-20 in-person voter registration you can, that doesn't necessarily prove residency, so you got to go to the additional step of proving your residency. It's all spelled out in the EDR handbook that we have, but basically that's the 30,000 feet overview of the difference.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kathy Newcomb. Your line is open.
Hi, I'd like to follow up on the question about the letter from the Secretary of State's office for lawyers. Could we possibly get a copy of that? Because that would be very easy to fudge up if you had, you know, anything with the Secretary of State's letterhead on it. You could fudge a letter, and we want to make sure that it's a real letter from an authorized person. Could we get the template for that ahead of time so we know what it looks like?
Yeah, I think we could certainly send out a sample. Now, don't forget it's on the Secretary's personal letterhead, not the agency. So that's actually even more difficult to get a hold of. But anyways, don't forget that I think what's lost in this is if we get a problem from your town that rises to the level of us having to send a volunteer attorney out, you're going to have heard from us already. In most instances, I mean, I can't say 100%, especially in those larger towns where maybe the phone is just chronically busy. But for the most part, we're going to try to reach out to you first to see what the problem is. And only if we don't get a satisfactory resolution are we going to bring it to that next level. And what I told Litchfield County yesterday was that, you know, if it rises to that level, you're probably going to have heard from us and say, hey, we're going to send somebody down. And so you'll have already known that. But separate and apart from all that, you know, we've all said that it would be okay to do a mock-up. So yeah, we can send some kind of sample out.
Okay, thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Irene. Your line is open.
Thank you. I just have a quick question. I want to make sure that it's okay that when we receive the Election Day registration, you know, we're going to be placing it in a secure box and everything. But we have four polling locations. Can we, during the day, bring those EDR votes, like when we bring the absentees, because we bring everything. We don't do anything central.
Sorry. So as long as it's not a ballot that you're holding for some reason because you're still waiting, someone had told you from another town where that person is registered that they're going to get back to you. So unless you're holding it for some reason, remember, as soon as you start counting absentees, which is, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, you can certainly, after that time, bring those ballots to the individual polling places to be put through the scan through the tabulator.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to double check on that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Carol Carrera. Your line is open.
Yes. It's my understanding we need an CIVS at EDR. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you very much.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. Our next question comes from Michael. You may begin. Michael, please check your mute button. Please ask your question.
Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. I have a question regarding a comment you made about an affirmation statement. Can you describe what exactly that is a little bit more?
Sure, absolutely.
I don't even know if I have it. No, go ahead.
So what we're talking about is, again, for veteran voters. So all of us on the call, including all of us around the table here, I say we're veteran voters. And so we can do a couple of different things when we walk into a polling place. Of course, we can provide ID, any one of the myriad of IDs, such as a driver's license or anything else that has name and photo, name and signature, et cetera. But if we don't have any of those and we are truly a veteran voter, there's also an affidavit that's available at the polls, where it's technically, I think, entitled an affidavit in lieu of identification, wherein the individual can just fill out a few things like name, address, et cetera, and sign it under penalties of false statement that they are who they say they are, and then they can go ahead and vote. But again, that's for the veteran voter. That is not for the individual who would have the asterisk next to their name on the registry list. And that's why, actually, we put the asterisk there, to let your official checkers know that those individuals would not be eligible for the affidavit.
That form is in your moderator's handbook, and I think it might be number 670, but don't quote me on that. It's something like that. But you'll find it in your moderator's handbook, and you can see what it looks like.
Okay, fine. The other question that I had was, you made a little notice, a mention of the state election posters versus a municipal. I'm not quite sure if I know what that title represents as far as what posters I've got.
Oh, okay. So I probably over-exaggerated when I said poster. It's actually, I think, an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper that we put together that is supposed to be, by statute now, posted at the checkers table. And what it does is it simply details the ID that is available and required of voters at a particular election. And we did two different PDFs. We did a state election version, which is the one you'll use this year, and a municipal election version, which, of course, you wouldn't use until next year.
Okay.
That's what I was talking about.
Can I find those PDFs?
We sent them out last year. If I can locate them, we can certainly shoot them out again. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I probably have or do have some or had them in the past. I just didn't quite recognize the description of them as to what they are, and I just want to make sure I've got some.
Yep, no worries. We can shoot an email out.
Yep.
And you'll shoot it to everybody, or?
Yes,
sure,
yeah,
we'll
yeah,
we
are. Yep.
Okay, great. I'll be waiting for it. Okay.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Wendy Harvey. You may begin.
Hi, Ted. I spoke with you briefly on this before. We have a woman who is currently homeless, searching for a home in our town, which is Kent. You had told me to speak with the social service department, and she could use the address of the town hall. I did receive the card from our social service woman. There is no address on there, nor is the 41 Kent Green Boulevard. on our system. Do I add it to our list of streets, or what do I write in that section?
So a homeless individual can register to vote, obviously, and they need to give you a physical location in town where they actually live and or sleep at night. So that could be as generic as, you know, the Central Park, you know, et cetera. So in that instance, then, yes, you would have to find a street location that is close enough to that park bench to put them in the appropriate district. Now, in Kent, are you just a single district town?
Yes.
So it's a little easier for you. So to the extent that that physical location is close enough to the town hall or wherever she's located, then that would be fine. The trick is just to make sure you get her in the appropriate voting district. But again, for you, it's a lot easier. So that's what I would go ahead and do.
So I could put her on North Main Street, which is close to 41 Green Boulevard, and have no number because she does have a post office box, so I can send her
letters. Yep. So the post office box would be the mailing address, and so the other would be your residence address, of course. And just try, I think CVR will accept a residence address without a street number because I believe it's programmed that way. But if it's not, you may have to put a street number in there. But I don't have it in front of me, so I can't verify that for you. But go ahead and give it a try.
Okay, and I do have another question, if I may, too, please.
All right. Well, hold on one sec. So we're at an hour, and we have some people backed up. So I'll take your question. But for the future callers, let's try to keep, you know, it rolling for the benefit of everybody else. So go ahead.
Sorry, just when you.
That's okay.
The ED250. Where do we get those?
So that's a supply from us. I believe that when we originally printed them, we gave each town enough to build a small village. So you should have plenty of them. But if you don't, you can order it from us, and we'll send you out some additional supplies.
Those are not the ones for the EDR, which the gray ones.
No, you got two different ones. I think the EDR is ED700. The EDR 250 is the provisional one. I think it's a light gray envelope with the application printed on the envelope.
Okay, I will look for that. Thank you.
Okay.
And
yep.
Another quick question is, somebody mentioned that the registrars hire the unofficial checkers. It was our understanding that it was the parties that gave us their list of people. Is that not correct?
Well, no. The parties give you the list, but the registrars appoint. So, yeah. I think that answers the question.
Yes, thank you.
I mean, in some towns, they pay unofficial checkers. So, in effect, you would have to hire them, quote-unquote. Some towns, they don't. So, anyways.
Thank you, speakers. The next question comes from Tim Beeble. Your line is open.
I had a question about the HAVA voters, and I'm referring to your October 13th guidance. And so, for voters subject to the identification provisions of HAVA, they have to present to the checker before the elector votes either a valid photo identification that shows the elector's name and address or a copy of a current utility bill, and it goes on. So these are voters who have done a mail-in registration. They have not provided a driver's license number nor a Social Security number. So their identity nor their residency can be confirmed. And it seems from this directive is that the utility bill, which we usually treat as proof of residency, is now going to be treated for these HAVA voters as identification as well.
Okay. Yeah, I that's the way the federal law is written. That's correct. But remember, there is an element of residency built in. I mean, you and I, if we were to move to a new town, we would not have to provide our driver's license nor our Social Security number, and we could register to vote by mail. And I think the important thing is to remember is that, you know, we send out a letter of acceptance, and if that is returned as undeliverable, there's additional steps you can take to remove or place that voter on the inactive list. So that letter of acceptance is also an important process. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if somebody is a first-time mail-in voter, not just a mail-in voter, a first-time mail-in voter, that's important because, you know, if I moved from Hebron to Colchester and I register to vote by mail, I'm not subject to the additional HAVA ID requirements. It's only first-time mail-ins. So if I'm a first-time mail-in voter and I don't provide driver's license or SOCH, last four digits on that, then I would be subject to the additional identification requirements. So, yes, I guess you're correct, yeah.
Okay, so in this case, just a utility bill is going to provide both identification and proof of residency.
Yeah, according to the federal law, sure.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks.
Thank you, speakers. Our next question comes from Sheila Hall. You may begin.
Hi. It's not Sheila, it's Olga, but we're all sitting around this phone. You guys answered two of the questions, but we're going to email at this point our question because we just want a small clarification on it. But we're okay. We're going to pass an email.
All right, great. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dale. Your line is open.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for doing this call. Very helpful. How do we handle people who want to vote but don't want to register to vote? Some examples of this, like I think sovereign citizens, do we give them provisional?
Well, no. So when I started out talking about provisional ballots, that's why I was presidential ballots. That's why I was bringing that up. So we used to have a presidential ballot wherein an individual who was a current Connecticut resident who was not registered could simply vote for president. That is no longer in the law. So anybody that wants to register to vote must either be registered or use the EDR process to register. We do not have anything in our statutes anymore that allow a resident of Connecticut who is not registered to vote.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Linda Grace. You may begin.
Thank you. I have a clarification on the election monitor. My understanding is Bridgeport does not have one.
That's correct, Linda.
So if someone showed up with saying they were one, we would ignore them and report it to you.
Yes,
sure.
You should call us definitely.
Yep.
If they showed up and said they were the regional election monitor, then.
Right. The only people that would likely show up in Bridgeport, Linda, would be an attorney sent by our office with the verification letter.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, we want a clarification on that. Cause
yeah, you're that's correct. Your COG is the one that does not have an REM, yeah.
And while we're on the line, I did want to tell Milford, if you're still on the line, that actually you're part of the South Central. So the good news is you do have a regional election monitor. His name is Mark Garofalo, I think, or something like that. And I will make sure he reaches out to you. He's actually newly hired, so that may be why you haven't heard from him.
Okay. Can we go to the next one?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Carol Young Kleinfeld. Your line is open.
During November 2nd through November 7th, what message will the online voter see or the new DMV voter see? And if they're allowed to enter their information during that time period, will the information be accessible to the EDR folks on reminders on Election Day?
So for the online system, Peggy and I just actually finished the notice that would be put up there. So during the period of the 2nd through the 7th, online voter reg simply won't be accessible. They'll get a message that says that they've missed the deadline and that they, if they're a matured rights voter, they would go to their registrar. If not, they have to wait until Election Day registration. For DMV, we have our election officer, Joan Gibson, who works directly with them. They will be reminded of and are very aware of the voter registration deadline of November 1st, just as they always have been, of course. And so those individuals will have the voter registration deadline as well.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Suzanne. You may begin.
I have two quick questions. One relates to the write-in list I just received on my email. It says 2nd Congressional District. Are these only the federal offices, and I might get another email with local, state rep and senator?
I know that we're sending out the write-ins, as I said before. We're working on them as we speak. I'm sitting on this conference call, so I do not know how Taffy is dividing them up and sending them out. I can double check with her on that, and we'll certainly send out an email clarification. But they should be sent today. That's all I know at this point.
I just know that in the past we have gotten everything in one email, and I was at a candidate forum on Monday night, and we have a write-in candidate for state rep, but he's not on this list of write-ins. So I'm just curious if another one is coming.
Yeah, I will double-check as soon as I'm off this phone call, and we will make sure and clarify if that's the case.
Thank you so much. And
you're
my
welcome.
Other question is about the registration cards we're receiving from the Secretary of State's office from your campaign to address unregistered voters in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
The postmarks, I mean, when we get closer to the election, the cutoff is it had to have been mailed by November 1st. Are you going to stop, not send us the ones, or are we going to have to somehow scrutinize these envelopes to figure out if they were in fact mailed by November 1st?
No, I believe what we do, and this is what we've done for years since I've been here, is Joan Gibson, actually, again, our election officer, takes over this process, and anything that comes in by the postmark, I believe she even cuts the postmarks off and sends them to you. And anything that is received after the postmark, I want to say she puts in some kind of little note or something. But I'll confirm with her on that to make sure that it's very clear.
Yeah, she generally does a letter to let you know that these were received after the deadline.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, speakers. Our next question is from Sue Armstrong. You may begin. Please stand by, speakers. One moment. Sue, your line is open.
Oh, thank you. My question is, a voter came in with a passport to register to vote. When the acceptance letter was sent out, it was sent back, returned by the post office as an invalid address. Does that person then get to vote provisional ballot?
Well, there's a couple of things that can happen with a voter like that. So the first thing is, since the letter of acceptance came back as undeliverable, you should take the additional steps to move them to an active. When the voter comes to the polls to vote, they can simply be restored if they have the proper information and they fill out the application for restoration, which I believe now is simply another application for voter registration. They can do that right at the polls, and they can be restored and go ahead and vote. So there would be no need for a provisional in that instance if they're successfully restored.
Okay, but if they're using the same invalid address, how does that work?
Well, do we know why the address is invalid?
See, sometimes what happens, Sue, is that their mailbox got knocked down by a car. There's some reason why, you know, it can't be delivered. So it's not always a case that they don't live there. So I think you'd have to determine what the circumstances are with this person.
Yeah.
Okay, so just restore them and they're fine.
It could be the case, yes. Yep.
Okay, great. Thank you for answering.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment for additional questions.
Okay. Well, I think at this point, seeing no additional questions, I think we'll call this a wrap. We've gone an hour and 25 minutes, so I think it was a great call. I'll turn it over to the deputy to close it out.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ted and Peggy, for all of your answers and guiding us through this call. I just would like to echo the secretary's remarks at the beginning of the call. thank you for all the hard work you do, especially in a time when every day when we turn on the news, we see the whole system around the country questioned. And we know from our personal experience how hard you work and how much you strive for fairness and accuracy every day. So we know you're working hard and the election will come off well. In the meantime, we stand ready to help you in any way we can via email or telephone call, and we also will be communicating with you. So thank you again, and with that, I will turn it over to Secretary Merrill for one final word.
Yes, I also thank all of you for tuning in. I think there's a lot of important information here, and it's much more complex than people realize, I think. If you do have any further questions, please feel free to email either Ted or Peggy, and we'll make sure we get those questions answered. I'm also seeing a note that says the call itself will be on the website tomorrow in case you didn't write things down or remember that a question was answered that you wanted to ask, and that would be great. And again, communication is the key. I'm very proud of our staff here. I know they try so hard to make sure that all of you have the information you need. So feel free to get in touch with any of us, and if there are any more questions, feel free to ask. And thank you so much for the work you do. More than ever, I am aware of how complex it is and how much everyone tries so hard to do things exactly the correct way. So thanks again, and I'll see you on Election Day, maybe. All right, thanks.
This concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.